You are now listening to the OrthoBullets podcast.
This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will be a question session reviewing multiple choice questions related to distal humerus fractures and pediatric supracondylar fractures, which are two topics that we covered this past week on the podcast. So let's get right into it. We'll start with distal humerus fractures, and the first question reads, what is the most common complication associated with open reduction and internal fixation using a 90-90 plate configuration and olecranon osteotomy for an OTA type C2 distal humerus fracture? And the choices are 1. Non-union of the lateral column, 2. Non-union of the medial column, 3. Non-union of the olecranon osteotomy, 4. Pain related to the plates, and 5. Pain related to the olecranon fixation. So the most common complications associated with open reduction and internal fixation of distal humerus fractures are those associated with repair of an associated olecranon osteotomy. Complications associated with olecranon osteotomy fixation include failure of fixation 5% of the time and the need for secondary removal of painful hardware 70% of the time. So the correct answer to this question is 5, pain related to the olecranon fixation. Non-union of a distal humerus fracture treated with 90-90 plating is uncommon and results from inadequate fixation, excessive soft tissue stripping, or use of inadequate plate fixation, such as 1/3 tubular plates. Heterotopic ossification is seen in approximately 4% of cases, infection in 4% of cases, and ulnar nerve palsy in 7% of cases. Although a relatively minor complication, the need for removal of painful hardware from the olecranon osteotomy is by far the most common complication seen in these cases. Moving on to the next question, compared with surgically treated patients, patients with extra-articular distal third humeral shaft fractures that are treated non-surgically with functional bracing can be expected to show which of the following findings, and the choices are 1. Similar loss of elbow motion, 2. Greater loss of elbow extension, 3. Higher rate of varus malalignment, 4. Higher rate of functionally limiting malalignment, and 5. Significantly better shoulder motion. So in a retrospective review of patients with extra-articular distal humeral shaft fractures treated surgically versus non-surgically, the authors found that the amount of motion loss was not different between the treatment groups. Of 21 patients in the non-surgical group, one lost 20 degrees of extension, one lost 30 degrees of extension, and one patient lost 15 degrees of flexion. Of the 19 patients in the surgical group, two patients lost 5 degrees of extension, and one each lost 10, 15, and 20 degrees of extension, respectively. One patient lost 5 degrees of flexion, and one lost 15 degrees of flexion. The average loss of motion in the surgical group was 3 degrees, compared with 6 degrees in the non-surgical group, but this difference was not significant. 100% of the non-surgically treated fractures healed. Both groups of patients regained shoulder motion within 10 degrees of normal. In the non-surgically treated group, 10 healed with less than 10 degrees of malalignment, 6 healed with 11 to 20 degrees of malalignment, and 3 healed with greater than 30 degrees of malalignment, but the authors did not report any functional problems due to these deformities. But the correct answer to this question is 1. Compared with surgically treated patients, patients with extra-articular distal third humeral shaft fractures that are treated non-surgically with functional bracing can be expected to show similar loss of elbow motion. Moving on to the next question. During a lateral approach to repair a distal 1/3 humeral shaft fracture, the radial nerve is found within the fracture site. The nerve is noted to be grossly in continuity and is carefully extracted. Radial nerve function is absent clinically in the postoperative period. 6 weeks after surgery, a nerve velocity conduction study and electromyogram are obtained. What finding is most consistent with a first-degree injury, aka a neuropraxia? And the choices are 1. Normal sensory conduction in the lateral antibrachial cutaneous nerve, 2. Normal amplitude and conduction velocity in the radial sensory nerve of the forearm, 3. Normal insertion activity in the flexor carpi ulnaris muscle, 4. Fibrillations in the extensor digitorum communis muscle, and 5. Strong motor unit action potentials in the triceps muscle. So, a neuropraxic or first-degree nerve injury is a lesion in which there is a focal conduction block within the nerve. There is no loss of continuity of the nerve fiber or axon sheath, and Wallerian degeneration is not observed. The end organs served by the injured nerve which are muscle end plates or sensory endings, do not develop the atrophic changes typical of a more severe nerve injury. While conduction across the focus of the nerve injury is inhibited, conduction is observed within the nerve, both proximal and distal to the lesion. The lateral antibrachial cutaneous nerve is not part of the radial nerve, and the flexor carpal narus muscle is not innervated by the radial nerve. The triceps is innervated by the radial nerve proximal to the area of the nerve injury, so action potentials in the triceps are not helpful in assessing distal radial nerve function. Fibrillations in the extensor digitorum communis, which is innervated by the posterior interosseous nerve, which is a branch of the distal portion of the radial nerve, are indicative of more severe nerve injury, which are grade 2 or grade 3. But the correct answer to this question is 2. The finding that is most consistent with a first-degree injury or neuropraxia is a normal amplitude and conduction velocity in the radial sensory nerve of the forearm. Moving on to the next question. A 60-year-old woman with a history of osteoporosis fell from a standing height and sustained a supracondylar distal humerus fracture with an intercondylar extension. Which of the following plate constructs yields the highest stiffness for fixation of the fracture? And the choices are 1. Single posterior Y plate, 2. Single medial plate with bicortical locking screws, 3. Dual plating with medial and posterolateral LCDCP, 4. Dual plating with medial and posterolateral 1/3 tubular plates, and 5. Dual plating with medial and lateral LCDCP. So optimal treatment of distal humeral fractures relies on reestablishment of a congruent articular surface with a fixation construct that is stable enough to allow for early range of motion. Several biomechanical studies have been performed to evaluate the biomechanical strength of various plating configurations. These studies have shown that dual plate configurations are more stable than single plates, regardless of the type of plate used. 1/3 tubular plates have been shown to be significantly weaker than LCDCP or reconstruction plates, resulting in weaker constructs and clinically higher rates of hardware failure and non-union. Whereas traditional teaching has suggested plating in perpendicular planes, recent biomechanical studies have demonstrated that parallel, medial, and lateral plates confer a greater rigidity to the construct than perpendicular plating schemes. So the correct answer to this question is 5. The plate construct that yields the highest stiffness for fixation of a distal humerus fracture is dual plating with medial and lateral LCDCP. Moving on to the next question. Which of the following patients is most appropriately treated with the total elbow arthroplasty? And the choices are 1. A 42-year-old laborer with an open T-type supracondylar distal humerus fracture. 2. A 90-year-old male with a comminuted transalacrinon fracture dislocation of the elbow. 3. A 66-year-old female with a coronal shear fracture of the distal humerus. 4. A 50-year-old male with a non-union of a supracondylar humerus fracture. And 5. An 86-year-old female with a comminuted bicolumnar distal humerus fracture. So total elbow arthroplasty has a limited but well-described indication for treatment of distal humerus fractures. Due to the postoperative patient limitations inherent to the current prosthesis, the current recommendation for the use of total elbow arthroplasty for distal humerus fractures is only for elderly patients with osteoporotic bone and comminution not amenable to stable fixation. McKee et al. Performed a randomized controlled trial of 42 patients comparing open reduction internal fixation to total elbow arthroplasty. Patients who had the total elbow arthroplasty had better Mayo elbow scores from 3 months until 2 years postoperatively, but DASH scores were only better in the total elbow arthroplasty group for the first 6 months, and they were equal thereafter. Reoperation rates were not statistically different, but note was made of a 25% intraoperative conversion rate from ORIF to total elbow arthroplasty after randomization. They conclude that this elderly population appears to adjust well to elbow limitations regardless of treatment. But to quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, a 42-year-old laborer with an open T-type supracondylar distal humerus fracture. This one is going to be treated with a dual plate fixation with placement of a separate strong plate on each column and orientation of the plates either at 90 degrees or 180 degrees to each other. And this is indicated for all adult fractures involving both columns of the distal part of the humerus. Answer 2, a 90-year-old male with a comminuted transalacrinon fracture dislocation of the elbow. This fracture pattern requires fixation of the ulna and possible reconstruction/repair of ligamentous injury. Answer 3, a 66-year-old female with a coronal shear fracture of the distal humerus. So displaced coronal shear fractures of the distal humeral articular surface require operative fixation, most typically via a lateral approach. And answer 4, a 50-year-old male with a non-union of a supracondylar humerus fracture. So non-union of a supracondylar humerus fracture typically requires revision with plate and screw constructs unless the patient is elderly. Moving on to the next question. Following fixation of a displaced intra-articular fracture of the distal humerus through a posterior approach, what is the expected outcome? And the choices are 1, development of arthritic changes at 1 year, 2, restoration of full elbow range of motion, 3, loss of approximately 25% of elbow flexion strength, 4, posterolateral rotatory instability, and 5, olecranon non-union. So following repair of a displaced intra-articular distal humerus fracture, the ability to regain full elbow range of motion is rare. Recent reports of olecranon osteotomy have yielded healing rates of between 95 to 100%. According to McKee and Associates, patients can be expected to have residual loss of elbow flexion strength of 25%. So the correct answer to this question is 3. Following fixation of a displaced intra-articular fracture of the distal humerus through a posterior approach, the expected outcome is loss of approximately 25% of elbow flexion strength. And the last question for this topic, a 71-year-old woman who reports long-term use of oral steroids for asthma is referred for treatment of a distal humerus fracture. Radiographs revealed diffuse osteopenia and a severely comminuted intra-articular fracture. What is the most appropriate treatment? And the choices are 1, long arm cast immobilization, 2, total elbow arthroplasty, 3, open reduction and internal fixation, 4, osteoarticular allograft, and 5, resection arthroplasty. So several studies have documented the satisfactory outcomes of total elbow arthroplasty when osteosynthesis is not feasible for fixation of a distal humerus fracture, particularly in the physiologically older patient with low functional demands. Total elbow arthroplasty should be considered when a comminuted intra-articular distal humerus fracture occurs in a woman older than age 65 years, particularly with such associated comorbidities as systemic steroid use, osteoporosis, or rheumatoid arthritis. So the correct answer to this question is 2, total elbow arthroplasty. Moving on to the next topic of pediatric supracondylar fractures, the first question reads, which of the following is incorrect regarding closed reduction and percutaneous pinning of a pediatric supracondylar humerus fracture using a lateral entry technique with 2 or 3 pins? And the choices are 1, it is the preferred first-line treatment for a displaced supracondylar humerus fracture, 2, it has level 1 evidence to support its superiority over the use of both medial and lateral entry pins, 3, it has equal radiographic outcomes compared to the use of both medial and lateral entry pins, 4, it has equal range of motion outcomes compared to the use of both medial and lateral entry pins, and 5, it causes fewer ulnar nerve injuries than the use of both medial and lateral entry pins. So level 1 evidence in the form of a prospective randomized controlled trial comparing lateral entry pinning with medial and lateral pinning demonstrates no difference on all outcome measures. So the correct answer to this question is 2. The statement that a closed reduction in percutaneous pinning of a pediatric supracondylar humerus fracture using a lateral entry technique with 2 or 3 pins has level 1 evidence to support its superiority over the use of both medial and lateral entry pins is an incorrect statement. Displaced supracondylar humerus fractures are amongst the most common pediatric fracture patterns. Completely displaced, that is a Gartland type 3, fractures are indicated for closed reduction and percutaneous pinning as first-line treatment, with many advocating for operative management of displaced type 2 fractures as well. Open treatment may be required if unable to achieve adequate reduction closed. The preferred fixation method is 2 to 3 laterally introduced divergent pins to achieve stability. Retrospective, prospective, and randomized control studies have all been conducted showing no worse outcomes with lateral entry pinning, and there is a presumed lower risk of ulnar nerve injury. However, especially in cases of medial column comminution, there may be some biomechanical advantage and need for a medial entry pin in some minority of cases. Skaggs et al. In 2004 reported a prospective series of 124 consecutively managed children, including both Gartland type 2 and Gartland type 3 fractures, and they report no patients with loss of reduction, no clinically evident deformity or loss of motion, and no iatrogenic nerve palsies. Coker et al. In 2007 reported a prospective randomized controlled trial comparing lateral entry versus lateral and medial entry pinning. This study was powered to detect a 10% difference in loss of reduction rate, and similar to prior prospective work, found no major loss of reduction, no statistically significant rate difference in minor loss of reduction, with 6 out of 28 in the lateral entry group and 1 out of 24 in the cross-pinning group, no iatrogenic nerve injury, and no significant differences in range of motion or clinical deformity outcomes. Moving on to the next question. A 10-year-old girl sustained a Gartland type 3 supracondylar fracture after falling off a trampoline 1 hour ago. She has a well-perfused hand but no palpable pulses. The remainder of her examination is otherwise normal. What is the next best step in treatment? And the choices are 1. Oblique radiographs, 2. Arteriogram, 3. Exploration of the brachial artery at the elbow, 4. Closed reduction and pinning of the elbow, and 5. Open reduction and internal fixation of the elbow. So most supracondylar fractures are extension type, and a Gartland type 3 is defined as a fracture that is completely displaced, i.e. there is no posterior cortical hinge. Treatment consists of closed reduction and pinning. Controversy exists over the use of a medial and lateral pin versus multiple lateral pins, as we just discussed. Although uncommonly needed, the surgeon should be prepared to open the fracture to achieve adequate reduction. A careful preoperative examination should be performed and documented. There is a growing body of evidence that patients with a normal neurovascular exam can be treated in a delayed fashion. Nevertheless, the initial evaluation cannot be delayed. If there is evidence of vascular compromise, the fracture should be reduced and pinned urgently and the limb reevaluated. So again, the correct answer to this question is 4, closed reduction and pinning of the elbow. Moving on to the next question. Longstanding cubitus varus as a result of a previously healed pediatric supracondylar fracture malunion may lead to development of which of the following? And the choices are 1. Ulnar neuropathy, 2. Median neuropathy, 3. Axillary neuropathy, 4. Radial neuropathy, and 5. Anterior interosseous neuropathy. So cubitus varus is a common malunion or deformity seen after pediatric supracondylar humerus fractures. Long-standing cubitus varus, in addition to being a cosmetic issue, has also been linked to an increased rate of lateral condyle fractures, posterolateral rotatory elbow instability, and late ulnar neuropathy. The most common nerve injured acutely in displaced extension-type supracondylar fractures is the anterior interosseous nerve. The most common nerve injured acutely in flexion-type supracondylar humerus fractures is the ulnar nerve. So the correct answer to this question is 1. Long-standing cubitus varus as a result of a previously healed pediatric supracondylar fracture malunion may lead to the development of ulnar neuropathy. Moving on to the next question, an 8-year-old boy sustains a 100% displaced extension-type supracondylar humerus fracture. Examination reveals no sensory deficit, capillary refill is approximately 1 second, the patient is unable to flex the index distal interphalangeal joint and the thumb interphalangeal joint. The remainder of the motor examination is normal. Which of the following best explains these physical findings? And the choices are 1. Volkmann ischemic contracture, 2. Radial nerve palsy, 3. Ulnar nerve palsy, 4. Median nerve palsy, and 5. Anterior interosseous nerve palsy. So preoperative nerve deficit is common in children with displaced extension-type supracondylar humerus fractures, approximately 20% of the time. Commonly injured nerves include the anterior interosseous nerve, which is a branch of the median nerve itself, and the radial nerve. The physical examination findings in this question are most consistent with an anterior interosseous nerve palsy, making 5 the correct answer to this question. The ulnar nerve is the most likely nerve to be injured in flexion-type supracondylar humerus fractures. And remember that the ulnar nerve is the most likely nerve to be injured in flexion-type supracondylar humerus fractures. Moving on to the next question. What is the etiology of cubitus varus following a supracondylar humerus fracture in a child? And the choices are 1. Overgrowth of the lateral physis, 2. Malreduction of the fracture, 3. Growth arrest of medial physis, 4. Injury to the ulnar nerve, and 5. Radial head dislocation. So cubitus varus is typically caused by malreduction of the fracture at the time of fixation, not usually by growth arrest. The study by France et al. Is a retrospective review of 84 patients with supracondylar fractures of the humerus treated by closed reduction and splinting, traction, or closed reduction and percutaneous pinning to determine the adequacy of the initial reduction and the maintenance of the reduction. Initially, Bauman's angle was adequate and similar in all patients, but the humeral capitellar angle was better with close reduction and percutaneous pinning. Maintenance of reduction in both planes was superior with close reduction percutaneous pinning, and significantly better clinical results were achieved by close reduction and percutaneous pinning. Nevertheless, there was no functional loss in any patient, and no parent wanted correction of deformity. So the correct answer to this question is 2. The etiology of cubitus varus following a supracondylar humerus fracture in a child is malreduction of the fracture. Moving on to the next question. Which of the following elbow apophyses is the last to fuse during growth? And the choices are 1. Capitellum, 2. External or the lateral epicondyle, 3. Radial head, 4. Internal or the medial epicondyle, and 5. The trochlea. So while the external or lateral epicondyle is the last apophysis to appear on radiographs, this question is asking for which of the apophyses is last to fuse. Therefore, the correct answer is the internal or medial epicondyle, which is the last to fuse around 16 to 19 years old. While the order of appearance is discussed way more often, it is helpful to know the typical order and age of apophyseal closure when evaluating teenagers, often throwers, with atraumatic elbow pain. An accepted mnemonic of the order of appearance of the individual ossification centers of the elbow is CRITOE, C-R-I-T-O-E, and that stands for capitellum, radial head, internal or medial epicondyle, trochlea, olecranon, and finally external or lateral epicondyle. Cheng et al. Performed a series to re-examine the sequence and pattern of elbow ossification based on a cross-sectional study of 3,154 elbow radiographs in children ranging in age from newborns to 17 years. The sequence of ossification in both boys and girls was found to be the same. The ages at which 50% of the girls were found to have positive radiologic ossification for each of these centers were ages 1, 5, 5, 9, 9, and 10 years respectively. In boys, with the exception of the capitellum, an average delay of 2 years was found in each of the ossification centers, although the sequence remained similar. But again, the correct answer to this question, which of the following elbow apophyses is last to fuse during growth, is 4, internal or medial epicondyle. Moving on to the next question. A 5-year-old boy sustains a type 2 supracondylar fracture, which is treated with cast immobilization. Healing results in mild gunstock deformity. Surgical treatment of this will most likely result in, and the choices are 1. Improved functional outcome, 2. Improved cosmesis, 3. Improved pain relief, 4. Improved range of motion, and 5. Reduced non-union rates. So a gunstock deformity, also known as cubitus varus, is the most common complication following a pediatric supracondylar humerus fracture. Cubitus varus typically does not affect range of motion, pain, function, or growth. However, cosmetic concerns or recurrent elbow fractures may result. Tardy ulnar nerve palsy may also result, but is not common. The primary indication for surgical correction of cubitus varus is cosmesis. Surgical treatment may result in neurovascular complications, lateral bone prominence, or failure to maintain correction. In a study by Ippolito et al., reviewing the long-term outcome of the treatment of cubitus varus with the supracondylar valgus osteotomy, it was discovered that all but 3 of the 24 patients were satisfied with their clinical and functional outcomes in spite of partial recurrence in almost all patients. Again, the correct answer to this question is 2, improved cosmesis. Moving on to the next question, what is the advantage of medial and lateral cross pins compared to 2 lateral pins in the treatment of supracondylar humerus fracture? And the choices are 1, greater ultimate clinical arc of elbow motion, 2, lower revision rate, 3, lower incidence of ulnar nerve injury, 4, greater experimental biomechanical stability, and 5, more anatomic fracture reduction. So supracondylar fractures of the humerus in children are commonly treated with close reduction and percutaneous pin fixation. Zions et al. Found maximum stability for supracondylar humerus fractures was provided by 2 cross pins placed from the medial and lateral condyles in a cadaveric laboratory study. Lee et al. Also found cross pins were more stable. No clinical difference has ever been shown between the various pin configurations. But the correct answer to this question is 4. The advantage of medial and lateral cross pins compared to 2 lateral pins in the treatment of supracondylar humerus fractures is greater experimental biomechanical stability. Moving on to the next question, an 8-year-old boy has a cubitus varus deformity of the left elbow after a supracondylar humerus fracture was treated in a splint. What is the most common cause of this deformity? And the choices are 1, malreduction causing malunion, 2, medial epicondyle growth arrest, 3, lateral condyle overgrowth, 4, medial epicondyle avascular necrosis, and 5, unrecognized compartment syndrome. So supracondylar humerus fractures are the most common elbow fractures in children, accounting for 60 to 80% of pediatric elbow fractures. While growth disturbance, vascular injury, compartment syndrome, and infection are recognized complications of supracondylar fractures and their treatment, none have ever been associated with the development of cubitus varus or gunstock deformity. This is usually the result of malunion caused by failure to reduce a collapsed medial column or failure to correct rotation at the fracture site. Current standard treatment for displaced supracondylar humerus fractures is reduction and pinning, whether closed or open. Cheng et al. Found an increase in closed reduction percutaneous pinning of supracondylar fractures from 4 to 40% over a 10-year period. Moving on to the next question. A displaced pediatric supracondylar humerus fracture is treated with closed manipulation and placement of 2 Kirschner wires placed on the lateral side. What would be the effect of adding a third pin from the lateral side? And the choices are 1, increase risk for iatrogenic ulnar nerve injury, 2, provide more construct stiffness than adding a medial pin, 3, improve construct stiffness in the presence of medial column comminution, and 4, will not affect construct stiffness in the presence of residual distal fragment internal rotation. So multiple biomechanical studies have shown that the addition of a third pin from the lateral side improves construct stiffness in the presence of medial column loss or slight internal rotation of the distal fragment. The same studies showed that addition of a medial pin, that is cross-pinning, has essentially the same benefit. And remember, placement of a medial pin increases the risk for iatrogenic nerve injury. But the correct answer to this question is 3. The effect of adding a third pin from the lateral side would improve construct stiffness in the presence of medial column comminution. Moving on to the next question. A 7-year-old boy is seen in the emergency department with an isolated and displaced supracondylar humerus fracture and absent radial and ulnar pulses. Despite a moderately painful attempt at realignment, examination reveals that his hand remains pulseless. What is the next appropriate step in management? And the choices are 1, order an urgent angiogram and then proceed to the OR, 2, repeat the reduction in the emergency department and reassess, 3, perform open reduction through an anterior approach, 4, perform closed reduction and pinning in the OR and reassess the vascular status, and 5, perform arterial repair and then stabilize the fracture. So displaced supracondylar humerus fractures in children may have associated vascular compromise. Decreased blood flow may be due to vessel injury, entrapment within the fracture site, kinking from fracture displacement, or from vessel spasm. Optimal initial treatment in the emergency department includes gentle realignment of the limb and vascular assessment. Angiography is not required in isolated injuries, as the level of the vessel compromise is always at the site of the fracture. When blood flow is not restored, the next best step in treatment is to proceed urgently to the operating room. A formal closed reduction and pinning is performed, and then the vascular status is reassessed. Exploration and vascular repair is required if the hand is cool, white, and without pulses. So again, the correct answer to this question is 4, the most appropriate next step in management for a 7-year-old boy with an isolated and displaced supracondylar humerus fracture and absent radial and ulnar pulses is to perform a closed reduction and pinning in the OR and reassess the vascular status. And the final question for this topic, late surgical treatment of post-traumatic cubitus varus or a gunstock deformity is usually necessitated by the patient reporting problems related to, and the choices are 1, tardy ulnar nerve palsy, 2, posterior glenohumeral subluxation, 3, posterior lateral rotatory subluxation of the elbow, 4, poor appearance, and 5, snapping medial triceps. So we've already done a similar question to this, but again, cubitus varus, elbow hyperextension, and internal rotation are all typical components of the gunstock deformity. This deformity results from malunion of a supracondylar fracture of the humerus. All the problems that we just listed have been reported as sequelae of a gunstock deformity, although the malunion usually causes no functional limitations. Unacceptable appearance is the most common reason why patients or parents request corrective osteotomy. That's all for this question review session about distal humerus fractures and pediatric supracondylar fractures. Hope that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.